Chapter 12. Wei, one of the saddest and the most pitiable that he had ever witnessed. "Why, my man," says he, "you're the boldest little chap in all England. You don't seem a bit afraid of being up here all by yourself in the dark." "The big winder," says the child, pointing up to it, "sees in the dark, and I see with the big winder." He stops a bit, and gets up on his legs, and looks hard at Benjamin's mother. "I'm a good un," says he, "ain't I? I save candle." Trottle wondered what else the forlorn little creature had been brought up to do without, besides candlelight, and risked putting a question as to whether he ever got a run in the open air to cheer him up a bit. Oh, yes, he had a run now and then, out of doors, to say nothing of his runs about the house, the lively little cricket a run according to good Mr. Forley's instructions, which were followed out carefully, as good Mr. Forley's friend would be glad to hear, to the very letter. As Trottle could only have made one reply to this, namely, that good Mr. Forley's instructions were, in his opinion, the instructions of an infernal scamp, and as he felt that such an answer would naturally prove the death blow to all further discoveries on his part, he gulped down his feelings, before they got too many for him, and held his tongue, and looked round towards the window again, to see what the forlorn little boy was going to amuse himself with next. The child had gathered up his blacking brush and bit of rag, and had put them into the old tin saucepan, and was now working his way, as well as his clothes would let him, with his make, believe pail hugged up in his arms, towards a door of communication which led from the back to the front garret. "I say," says he, looking round sharply over his shoulder, "what are you two stopping here for? I'm going to bed now and, so I tell you." With that, he opened the door, and walked into the front room. Seeing Trottle take a step or two to follow him, Benjamin's mother opened her wicked old eyes in a state of great astonishment. "Mercy on us," says she, "haven't you seen enough of him yet?" "No," says Trottle. "I should like to see him go to bed." Benjamin's mother burst into such a fit of chuckling that the loose extinguisher in the candlestick clattered again with the shaking of her hand. "To think of good Mr. Forley's friend taking 10 times more trouble about the imp than good Mr. Forley himself." Such a joke as that, Benjamin's mother had not often met with in the course of her life, and she begged to be excused if she took the liberty of having a laugh at it. Leaving her to laugh as much as she pleased, and coming to a pretty positive conclusion, after what he had just heard, that Mr. Forley's interest in the child was not of the fondest possible kind, Trottle walked into the front room, and Benjamin's mother, enjoying herself immensely, followed with the candle. There were 2 pieces of furniture in the front garret. 1, an old stool of the sort that is used to stand a cask of beer on, and the other a great big rickety straddling old truckle bedstead. In the middle of this bedstead, surrounded by a dim brown waste of sacking, was a kind of little island of poor bedding and old bolster, with nearly all the feathers out of it, doubled in 3 for a pillow, a mere shred of patchwork counterpane, and a blanket, and under that, and peeping out a little on either side beyond the loose clothes, 2 faded chair cushions of horsehair, laid along together for a sort of makeshift mattress. When Trottle got into the room, the lonely little boy had scrambled upon the bedstead with the help of the beer stool, and was kneeling on the outer rim of sacking with the shred of counterpane in his hands, just making ready to tuck it in for himself under the chair cushions. "I'll tuck you up, my man," says Trottle. "Jump into bed, and let me try." "I mean to tuck myself up," says the poor forlorn child, "and I don't mean to jump. I mean to crawl, I do, and so I tell you." With that, he set to work, tucking in the clothes tight all down the sides of the cushions, but leaving them open at the foot. Then, getting up on his knees, and looking hard at Trottle as much as to say, "What do you mean by offering to help such a handy little chap as me?" he began to untie the big shawl for himself, and did it too, in less than half a minute. Then, doubling the shawl up loose over the foot of the bed. He says, I say, look here, and ducks under the clothes, head first, worming his way up and up softly, under the blanket and counterpane, till Trottle saw the top of the large nightcap slowly peep out on the bolster. This oversized headgear of the child's had so shoved itself down in the course of his journey to the pillow, under the clothes, that when he got his face fairly out on the bolster, he was all nightcap down to his mouth. He soon freed himself, however, from this slight encumbrance, by turning the ends of the cap up gravely to their old place over his eyebrows. Looked at Trottle, said, snug, ain't it? Goodbye. Popped his face under the clothes again, and left nothing to be seen of him, but the empty peak of the big nightcap standing up sturdily on end in the middle of the bolster. What a young limb it is, ain't it? Says Benjamin's mother, giving Trottle a cheerful dig with her elbow. Come on. You won't see no more of him tonight. And so I tell you. Sings out a shrill, little voice under the bedclothes, chiming in with a playful finish to the old woman's last words. If Trottle had not been, by this time, positively resolved to follow the wicked secret which accident had mixed him up with, through all its turnings and windings, right on to the end, he would have probably snatched the boy up then and there, and carried him off from his garret prison, bedclothes and all. As it was, he put a strong check on himself, kept his eye on future possibilities, and allowed Benjamin's mother to lead him downstairs again. Mind them top banisters, says she, as Trottle laid his hand on them. They are as rotten as meddlers, every one of them. When people come to see the premises, says Trottle, trying to feel his way a little farther into the mystery of the house, you don't bring many of them up here, do you? Bless your heart alive, says she, nobody ever comes now. The outside of the house is quite enough to warn them off. More's the pity, as I say. It used to keep me in spirits, staggering them all, one after another, with the frightful high rent, specially the women, drat 'em. What's the rent of this house? £120 a year. £120? Why, there ain't a house in the street as lets for more than 80. Likely enough, ma'am. Other landlords may lower their rents if they please, but this here landlord sticks to his rights, and means to have as much for his house as his father had before him. But the neighborhood's gone off since then. £120, ma'am. The landlord must be mad. £120, ma'am. Open the door, you impertinent woman. Lord. What a happiness it was to see 'em bounce out, with that awful rent a-ringing in their ears all down the street. She stopped on the second floor landing, to treat herself to another chuckle, while Trottle privately posted up in his memory what he had just heard. 2 points made out, he thought to himself. The house is kept empty on purpose, and the way it's done, is to ask a rent that nobody will pay. Ah, dearie me, says Benjamin's mother, changing the subject on a sudden, and twisting back with a horrid, greedy quickness to those awkward money matters which she had broached down in the parlor. What we've done, one way and another for Mr. Forley, it isn't in words to tell. That nice little bit of business of ours ought to be a bigger bit of business, considering the trouble we take, Benjamin and me, to make the imp upstairs as happy as the day is long. If good Mr. Forley would only please to think a little more of what a deal he owes to Benjamin and me, that's just it, says Trottle, catching her up short in desperation, and seeing his way, by the help of those last words of hers, to slipping cleverly through her fingers. What should you say, if I told you that Mr. Forley was nothing like so far from thinking about that little matter as you fancy? You would be disappointed, now, if I told you that I had come today without the money? Her lank old jaw fell, and her villainous old eyes glared, in a perfect state of panic, at that. But what should you say if I told you that Mr. Forley was only waiting for my report to send me here next Monday at dusk with a bigger bit of business for us two to do together than ever you think for? What should you say to that? The old wretch came so near to Trottle before she answered, and jammed him up confidentially, so close into the corner of the landing that his throat, in a manner, rose at her. Can you count it off, do you think, on more than that? Says she, holding up her four skinny fingers and her long crooked thumb, all of a tremble, right before his face. What do you say to two hands instead of one? Says he, pushing past her, and getting downstairs as fast as he could. What she said Trottle thinks it best not to report, seeing that the old hypocrite, getting next door to light-headed at the golden prospect before her, took such liberties with unearthly names and persons which ought never to have approached her lips, and rained down such an awful shower of blessings on Trottle's head, that his hair almost stood on end to hear her. He went on downstairs as fast as his feet would carry him, till he was brought up all standing, as the sailors say, on the last flight, by aggravating Benjamin, lying right across the stair, and fallen off, as might have been expected, into a heavy drunken sleep. The sight of him instantly reminded Trottle of the curious half-likeness which he had already detected between the face of Benjamin, and the face of another man, whom he had seen at a past time in very different circumstances. He determined, before leaving the house, to have one more look at the wretched muddled creature, and accordingly shook him up smartly, and propped him against the staircase wall, before his mother could interfere. Leave him to me, I'll freshen him up, says Trottle to the old woman, looking hard in Benjamin's face, while he spoke. The fright and surprise of being suddenly woke up seemed, for about a quarter of a minute, to sober the creature. When he first opened his eyes, there was a new look in them for a moment, which struck home to Trottle's memory as quick and as clear as a flash of light. The old maudlin sleepy expression came back again in another instant, and blurred out all further signs and tokens of the past. But Trottle had seen enough in the moment before it came, and he troubled Benjamin's face with no more inquiries. Next Monday, at dusk, says he, cutting short some more of the old woman's palaver about Benjamin's indigestion. I've got no more time to spare, ma'am, tonight. Please to let me out. With a few last blessings, a few last dutiful messages to good Mr. Forley, and a few last friendly hints, not to forget next Monday at dusk, Trottle contrived to struggle through the sickening business of leave-taking, to get the door opened, and to find himself, to his own indescribable relief, once more on the outer side of the house to let. Let at last, there, ma'am, said Trottle, folding up the manuscript from which he had been reading, and setting it down with a smart tap of triumph on the table. May I venture to ask what you think of that plain statement, as a guess on my part and not on Mr. Jarber's, at the riddle of the empty house? For a minute or two I was unable to say a word. When I recovered a little, my first question referred to the poor forlorn little boy. Today is Monday the 20th, I said. Surely you have not let a whole week go by without trying to find out something more? Except at bedtime, and meals, ma'am, answered Trottle, I have not let an hour go by. Please to understand that I have only come to an end of what I have written, and not to an end of what I have done. I wrote down those first particulars, ma'am, because they are of great importance, and also because I was determined to come forward with my written documents, seeing that Mr. Jarber chose to come forward, in the first instance, with his. I am now ready to go on with the second part of my story as shortly and plainly as possible, by word of mouth. The first thing I must clear up, if you please, is the matter of Mr. Forley's family affairs. I have heard you speak of them, ma'am, at various times, and I have understood that Mr. Forley had two children only by his deceased wife, both daughters. The eldest daughter married, to her father's entire satisfaction, One Mr. Bain, a rich man, holding a high government situation in Canada. She is now living there with her husband, and her only child, a little girl of 8 or 9 years old. Right so far, I think, ma'am?
Quite right, I said.
The second daughter, Trottle went on, and Mr. Forley's favorite, set her father's wishes and the opinions of the world at flat defiance, by running away with a man of low origin, a mate of a merchant vessel, named Kirkland. Mr. Forley not only never forgave that marriage, but vowed that he would visit the scandal of it heavily in the future on husband and wife. Both escaped his vengeance, whatever he meant it to be. The husband was drowned on his first voyage after his marriage, and the wife died in childbed.
Right again, I believe, ma'am?
Again quite right. Having got the family matter all right, we will now go back, ma'am, to me and my doings. Last Monday, I asked you for leave of absence for 2 days. I employed the time in clearing up the matter of Benjamin's face. Last Saturday I was out of the way when you wanted me. I played truant, ma'am, on that occasion, in company with a friend of mine, who is managing clerk in a lawyer's office, and we both spent the morning at Doctor's Commons, over the last will and testament of Mr. Forley's father. Leaving the will business for a moment, please to follow me first, if you have no objection, into the ugly subject of Benjamin's face. About 6 or 7 years ago, thanks to your kindness, I had a week's holiday with some friends of mine who live in the town of Pendlebury. One of those friends, the only one now left in the place, kept a chemist's shop, and in that shop I was made acquainted with one of the two doctors in the town, named Barsham. This Barsham was a first-rate surgeon, and might have got to the top of his profession, if he had not been a first-rate blackguard. As it was, he both drank and gambled, nobody would have anything to do with him in Pendlebury, and, at the time when I was made known to him in the chemist's shop, the other doctor, Mr. Dix, who was not to be compared with him for surgical skill, but who was a respectable man, had got all the practice, and Barsham and his old mother were living together in such a condition of utter poverty that it was a marvel to everybody how they kept out of the parish workhouse. Benjamin and Benjamin's mother. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.